This is Dylan FM, a freak music club podcast on Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Well, I mean, certainly it was apparent from the first time one heard the album that it was a return to form. It was the best thing he'd done for years. It was completely in the pocket, as they say.
Howard Soons is the author of Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan. It's a comprehensive biography written by a former journalist based on over 250 interviews with names like Al Kooper, T-Bone Burnett, Nora Guthrie, and many more. And unlike other Dylan biographies, it's up to date, having been revised in 2021, so it covers even the release of Rough and Rowdy Ways. Before we dig into the recording of Time Out of Mind, I wanted to spend some more time looking at those years before the album was recorded. Howard's book does a great job of describing Dylan in the early 90s with insights from many people who were there, and I thought that speaking with him would be a great way to get a sense of where Bob was in his career and in the period leading up to the recording of Time Out of Mind. Howard has written well-reviewed books on Lou Reed, Paul McCartney, Charles Bukowski, and others. And as you'll hear, he's a knowledgeable and lifelong Dylan fan and a thoughtful observer of his life and work. In our conversation, we talk about the process of writing a big biography, drill down on where Bob was in his life in the early 90s, and then we discuss Time Out of Mind and the reception it received. Howard also shares stories about some of the amazing people he spoke with, including Suze Rotolo, Sally Grossman, Echo Hellstrom, William Zantzinger, and more. Check the show notes or our website for a link to get a copy of his book in print or on Kindle. It's called Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan. Now, on to our Howard Soons interview.
A great place to start would be how you came to take on this project. Were you a Dylan fan? Did you see the opportunity in the market? What brought you to do such a big project and spend so much time on Dylan?
Well, I just started my life as a full-time writer. I'd written one book, which was a bestseller, and I needed a new book. And I wanted to write a biography, and I had lunch with a publisher, and we both were Bob Dylan fans, actually. And I had been since I was a teenager and had seen the shows and read all the books, and I was just a fan. And my publisher friend was a fan, and he said, oh, well, Bob Dylan's going to be 60 in 2 years' time. And I kind of said, oh, I didn't know that. I hadn't realized that. He said, well, that's a opportunity to write a book. And that's when the light bulb went off. And I thought, oh, I didn't realize that Bob being 60 would be such a big deal in terms of a marketing opportunity for a book. And he said, yeah, that's going to be a big opportunity if you want to do it. And then I went off and got a contract to write this book. And so, you know, it was done out of a genuine existing love and interest in Bob Dylan's music, which went back to when I was about 15, 14. And I first saw him live when I was about that age, actually. But it was then a business opportunity. But having had that opportunity, I grasped it. You know, I really went for it in a big way. And I spent 2 years on it and spent a lot of time and money really investigating him as a man, because biography is the story of a life, you know. Biography is different to writing about music. Biography is the story of a man's or a woman's life. And it has to have a kind of narrative arc, and it's about the personal life and the work and everything, the personality. And I used to be a newspaper journalist. That's my background. So I was trained to find stuff out and investigate people. And essentially, that's what I did. I investigated Bob Dylan for 2 years.
So the idea of that approach, and especially as we'll talk about, one of the notable things about this book is the original number is 250 interviews, and the name list is unbelievable. So you knew you were going to do that approach because as a journalist, that was your background. Was taking that approach to Dylan particularly difficult? Which I guess means, is the veil of secrecy they're all sworn to real? And did you encounter it?
Well, here's the surprising thing. There was an onus on me to do a really good job, because to be frank, I was paid a lot of money to do this book. So I had money, I had time, had a good publisher, but they really wanted they wanted something substantial. And one way of kind of showing off is to say, oh, I've interviewed 200 people. So there's a little bit of that, there's a bit of marketing in that. But having said that, I really did set out to try and speak to everyone I could. I wouldn't take no for an answer. I went after people. I went to where they lived. I went after them in a really, I wouldn't say an aggressive way, but a really determined way. And the surprising thing is that actually it was quite easy, because Bob Dylan comes from a kind of bohemian background, intellectual bohemian friends who are, independent thinkers. They don't like being told what to do. And if you go to see, let's say, Dave Van Ronk or Suze Rotolo or someone like that and say, look, do you want to do an interview for a book? They will decide on their own whether they want to do it or not. Their first reaction won't be, oh, what does Bob think? Because they're not that sort of people. They're kind of freewheeling people, to use a cliche. And indeed, in the few times when they did try to ask Bob, they couldn't get hold of him because he's so remote. He's so remote, they just couldn't get hold of him, And the real test of this was when I interviewed some of his family, and I got the impression that, A, he knew about it right from the start. Well, he did, because I wrote to him right at the start, but he didn't give a shit. He just didn't give a shit, which was very, very refreshing and very, very enabling for the biographer. And I've had the opposite experience with big stars when they're very controlling and they try and make your life really difficult, and they can. But Bob just, he knew about it from the start. He didn't give a shit. And as a result, a lot of people spoke to me. And of course, the other thing is, when I did this book 20 years ago, a lot of people were alive who are not around now.
Yeah, no, I noted that as I went through the list. And there's a couple of them that later I might want to ask you about, specific people that I don't know anyone that talked to, and it'd be interesting to hear something else about those conversations. But the beginning of your book I found interesting in that you start at the 30th anniversary celebration and with a really interesting story that clearly came from inside information about Bob's experience with that. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about that as the setup, and then we'll talk forward and backwards relative to Time Out of Mind?
I needed an introduction to the book. I needed a scene in terms of constructing a story. So I didn't want to open in 1941 in Minnesota. I wanted, or even before that, I wanted to open now, as it were, Bob Dylan now, as a famous, important, revered person. And so I needed a kind of a scene, something that he had done in recent years. And I, of all the people I spoke to, one of the things that just kind of lent itself to that as a device, as a prologue, essentially, to a book, was this anniversary concert at Madison Square Garden. And in particular, an interview I did with a guy whom you and fans would heard of, called Tommy Makim, who was one of those Irish folk singers from Greenwich Village, from Bob's very early years in New York, one of those guys that he met when he was just a young guy making his name. And by 1992, Tommy Makim was running a bar in Manhattan, kind of a pub, I suppose, Irish pub. And Bob Dylan, he told me this story about how Bob Dylan came in one night, just came in on his own. They hadn't seen each other for years. And Makim was quite interesting in his observation about Bob being a kind of lonely, isolated, middle-aged man, very famous, but no one with him, and a bit melancholy, perhaps. That's how Makim read him. And then this tied into the concert, because then Bob had this huge concert at Madison Square Garden, televised event, George Harrison, Eric Clapton, all these sort of superstar people. And then he had the after-show party at Tommy Makim's bar. And so, in terms of a writer writing a book, it was just a nice kind of, it made 2,500 words. I could encapsulate lots of ideas in it. And then I could then look back, I could then say to the reader, well, how did Bob Dylan get to this stage in life?
Where was he in 93? And what did you learn about the 10 years or so that brought him there?
Well, I suppose if you wanted to reduce it down to a soundbite, you could say he was having a kind of midlife crisis. He was in his, late 50s then? by this stage, or mid-50s, no, early-50s. But he seemed older. He'd lived, he'd had a long career already. And in the 10 years previously, well, at the time, for instance, I really hated the gospel stuff when I was a teenager, an atheist. I was just horrified that my hero was, became a born-again Christian. I thought he'd gone mad, you know. I just was horrified. Now I'm now an older person. I now see actually those were really terrific records. But then they had, we had all those terrible, from Infidels onwards, it was just a sort of a sad decline, really, where he clearly just wasn't, he just didn't feel comfortable, or he lost his way, he lost his path in life. I think personally and professionally, he didn't really give a shit. He was bored, perhaps. He didn't quite know what he was doing or what he wanted to do. I mean, of course, there are exceptions. I mean, there's Oh Mercy and things like that. But I mean, when you look back on Empire Burlesque and Knocked Out Loaded and Down in the Groove, they're such disappointing records. I think in every case, there's at least one track on it that's interesting. I mean, he's always interesting, whatever he does. Even if he sang the phone book, you know, he'd be interesting. But it was a kind of, you know, a sort of a, there was obviously a great artist here, a great figure in the arts who was going through a fallow period up to, I suppose, those two cover albums, you know, especially World Gone Wrong, which seemed to be a turning point, really.
So that sort of sullenness and what you describe relative to the back of the bar at Tommy Makem's is kind of where he was, but it was interesting because at that same time, the myth-making machine had begun. You know, we had Biograph, and then we've already have now, you know, the bootleg series. We're having things like a 30th anniversary event, or having the Kennedy Center Honors. I guess that's a little bit later. But I sort of wonder about the myth machine going on its own track over here, and then Bob's day-to-day life going on, which is, you know, there's some complexity to how those, you know, those two trains running side by side going kind of different places. Do you think that put extra pressure on him, or do you think, did he actually ignore the myth making as much as it's made out to be that he ignores it?
Well, I think you always have to remember that Bob Dylan, like all people like this, like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, all these people, however wonderful they are, they're in show business, and show business is selling yourself, and you use your persona and your past, your history, to sell records. You know, that's the business you're in, and he's in that business just the same as anyone else. And so he uses his past. I mean, he's done it right from when he was a kid, hasn't he? Of course, making up his biography, saying that he was a gypsy and a hobo and all this stuff. I mean, he changed his name. I mean, he became somebody who he isn't actually. He became this. He dreamt up this character, and then he became this character. It's all play acting, really. And that's never going to stop. And it had been going for 25 years by the time Time Out of Mind came along. And he seemed old and weary. I mean, the funny thing is, I mean, first time I saw him live was 81. And I thought, my goodness me, he's a middle-aged man. But now I realize he was only 40. But even then, you know, an awful lot had happened. I mean, 20 years of stuff had happened. There was lots of legendary stuff. He seemed like a mythological figure almost, but like Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare is such an extraordinary big figure that he seems almost as if he didn't exist. And Bob Dylan sometimes seemed like that. But I mean, I think, you know, he will use anything. He'll use the Grammys and the Kennedy Center and the Nobel Prize and a Martin Scorsese special. He'll use everything to his advantage in a fairly cynical way, actually.
Do you ever get the sense when you have all these conversations with people who've, you know, known him intimately and have been involved, that is this separation between the myth and the character and the real person? You know, I mean, there's some celebrities, you know, that they're on and they're playing that part, and you know 80% of the time they're off and they have a different relationship with somebody. You know, with Bob, it does seem like that, you know, he even talks about Bob Dylan in the third person, and he's this character he plays. Did you ever get any sense of that separation from these insider conversations you had of the way people's relationships with him were?
Yeah, I mean, and certainly over time. So the people who were easiest to get to, the ones who were alive, were the people who knew him at the start of his career, because most of them hadn't become superstars. So people from the village and from Minnesota, they were very accessible. And of course, they all to a man told the story of Bob being a character that he invented and play acted, and could be quite cold, in fact, to people from his past. And that's part of the process of being the biographer, is that, you know, so-and-so rings up the office to say, Bob, you know, Howard Soons is here, wants an interview, shall I do it? And they can't give an answer because they can't even get hold of the guy. And some of them get quite upset about that. They go backstage to see him and he won't see them, you know, or he walks straight past them or something. But I mean, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think he's also obviously a very, very brilliant and talented and extraordinary person. So he's that as well. So the Bob Dylan who writes those songs, that is coming out of this extraordinary original mind. And that's not play acting. You know, he's not play acting that. Obviously, the songs, there's a real sincerity to the work, which is why we all love him and admire him. But at the same time, he's in show business, you know. So I think that both those things are going on. And I think somewhere along the line, you know, little Robert Zimmerman from Minnesota certainly must have got lost, or it's like a little pea in his pocket somewhere, because Victor Mahmoudis was very good on this, you know, his road manager, who really hated him, that was very bitter at the end. But he was very good on how Bob had grown as a man. You know, he was a timid little boy, and then he became this sort of very urbane, worldly, grand figure, you know, who, like all those people, those rock stars of the 60s, they became so wealthy and renowned and worldly in every sense, that they changed as people. They were transformed into sort of an aristocracy, really, a modern aristocracy.
In this period, meaning the early 90s, sort of around the time of World Gone Wrong and Good As I've Been to You, the 30th anniversary event was right in the middle of those two releases. How is the industry treating him? How is he feeling, you know, reputationally? So this is where I think there's this dichotomy, right? They're having a grand celebration of him, and yet, you know, he feels down in the industry. We're right on the beginning of Time Out of Mind, which is going to come out of nowhere and be this big left turn in his career. How is the insiders treating him at that point? Was there any expectations left other than, you know, we're going to ring the old bell a lot of times?
As is well known, he is and always has been a prestige artist for Columbia, and they treat him differently to most of their artists. They give him a lot of leeway, and they're proud of having him on their books. And of course, you know, Columbia and his management and everyone who's working with him, the lawyers and the accountants, and, you know, all these people are constantly making decisions about making money with him. They want to give his career a shot in the arm at every stage, you know, every year. What are we going to do this year? You know, what can we sell this year? Well, it's the anniversary. In fact, I don't even think it was the anniversary. It was sort of 1 year off, I think, in chronology. But somebody said, oh, let's have this jamboree for Bob's 30th anniversary. And it was a pretty dreary concert, I thought. I mean, these things often are, pretty boring, not really very interesting or artistically successful. I think it's just a way of making money, and I think he just went along with it. Not making money. In fact, I don't think he did make much money. I mean, one of the people I interviewed, one of the good quotes in the book is, I forget who says it, you know, they got royalty statements, all the guest artists. And, you know, you get the number of sales, you know, CD sales in Denmark, you know, two copies. I mean, it wasn't a big seller, the CD or the DVD or the VHS or whatever the hell it was. But it helped put him in the, you know, get him back in the news, and it helped keep his name alive, I suppose, which is what they're trying to do all the time, aren't they, the music management people.
So then he goes and creates World Gone Wrong, and kind of has that period of going to ground a little bit with the folk songs. Let's move into the Time Out of Mind period. Where did that begin? Meaning there hadn't been, you know, there's 7 years between an original Bob Dylan song. I couldn't find 18 months before that when there was ever a gap between an original Bob Dylan song, right? These songs start to be written. I think you have a couple stories about, I think, him with Ronnie Wood in Ireland somewhere, and then they eventually are shown to Lenoir. What do you remember, or what comes to mind in terms of the emergence of the Time Out of Mind material?
I don't remember a lot, to be honest, because it's 20 years since I wrote the book, and that sort of detail is become foggy. Yeah. One of the sort of memories or impressions I had was that I know that up to around 1990, which I think was Red Sky and the Wilburys album,
yeah,
a member of his family actually said to me that he was feeling he was being spread too thin. He didn't like doing the Wilburys album, the second one anyway. He kind of went along with it, and he was kind of juggling. He had tours booked. He had his own album. He had the Wilburys album, and he was pretty fed up. He was trying to do too much. And maybe that's a part of the explanation for why that album was so poor and why he then took a long break. And then one of his girlfriends was quite a good interview in the book. She says that there was this point around this time when he decided to rebuild his career, rebuild his stage show, certainly from the ground up. And Victor used to speak about that, that they started playing smaller places and, you know, they're kind of working, changing the act and kind of work, sort of starting from the ground up, as it were, trying to get back to the root of what he was about. And I think that was a long, slow process.
So yeah, the Never Ending Tour started in 88 and that kind of relentless backroads touring process. So you talked to a number of the musicians, Augie Myers, Cindy Cash Dollar, and a few others that worked on Time Out of Mind. And I know, you know, all the minutiae is not your specialty, but anything about the Lenoir era, and I don't know if you talked to Daniel, I know you had.
No, he wouldn't talk to me at the time. So I certainly tried. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he said a lot since, which I didn't know. So, I just remember a few sort of impressions from the musicians saying, you know, that they all sat round in this big room and he was kind of making it up to some extent as he went along. Augie Myers told this very good story about playing Make Me Feel My Love, I think, when Bob was very diffident about playing the piano. And Augie had to encourage him to play the piano because he didn't think he was a good enough piano player, which I thought was quite revealing. And Augie said, you know, at the end, and of course, there's this thing where he gets ill afterwards, and often that's, and it was in my mind, I think, in all our minds, we conflate that album with him being ill, but of course, it's the album precedes him being ill. But he was, you know, a man of a certain age, and I think he'd lived, in some respects, an exhausting life. And I think Augie said that, you know, he was very tired at the end of the sessions. You'd go home looking pretty wrung out by it all. But that could be a lot of, you know, there could be lots of reasons for that. I mean, obviously, he really gave that album his full attention, which is partly why it's so good. And also, I'm sure intellectually and emotionally, the lyrics are very, there seems to be a lot of him in it. That's the thing I find most interesting about it. There seems to be a lot of him in it. But of course, we don't really know that because we don't really know how much of that is just him play acting, or whether that's really, you know, really how he felt about life at the time.
From those musicians, do you get a sense? I mean, obviously, you know, there's always profound respect when the musicians who work with him talk about him. Did you get a sense of anything else about their relationship? Meaning, are they, you know, is it a distant, respectful relationship, or do they really get, you know, a little bit more intimately involved and feel good about Bob more as a person than as a figure, or anything else you want to say about having talked to, you know, Augie and Cindy and I think Keltner, maybe you spoke to as well.
Yeah. I spoke to him last night, funnily enough, but not about this. Well, I think it depends on the musician. I mean, of course, the thing about Bob Dylan is he's played with a very large number of musicians over his career, and some of them have been with him longer than others, and some of them became very friendly with him. But if you're talking about Time Out of Mind, I would say there was a certain, you know, Bob's the boss, you know, deference to the boss, not saying the wrong thing, being careful what you say, in fact. It's not knockabout fun, you know, you don't slap him on the back and tell jokes necessarily, you know, you do your business and you turn up on time and it's, So I think there's that. I don't think it's necessarily a free and easy relationship. And of course, he's a bit of a remote sort of person. I think that comes through in all the interviews I did, that he's a fairly remote personality and can appear a bit cold at times.
Yeah, that attention to detail on this album you mentioned, I think, is another distinction about it. And in Lenoir's book, and Mark Howard wrote a book, and listening to master tapes and editing and things, that often you hear stories that after the recording, he kind of washes his hands and lets it come out. I wonder if he either sort of saw how good the material was here and the potential to do this right was there, or maybe it was the 10 years or 9 years off or 7 years off, he was just more interested. So something made him take a different approach to this album, than many others. And then it paid off, which brings us to the, the reaction and the reception. It seems like it really got noticed quickly, and Bob reacted to that acceptance.
Yeah. Well, that's all true, isn't it? I don't know what made him turn the corner artistically. I don't know. I mean, I'd be guessing. But I mean, certainly it was apparent from the first time one heard the album that it was a return to form. It was the best thing he'd done for years. It was, completely in the pocket, as they say. It was just so much better than anything he'd done, I think, since Blood on the Tracks, really. That you suddenly feel, thank goodness me, Bob is has found his way again. And how that happened, why that happened, maybe even he doesn't know. It could be all sorts of things. It might just be, we just don't know. We really, I don't know anyway. But other than it seemed to be a kind of a process, you see an inkling of it with World Gone Wrong. You see there, I would say what you see there is you see that he's found a way to express himself as an older person, and he's found a kind of older persona of being this rather world-weary, cynical observer of life being shit. And he's decided to inhabit that persona, which is like a new character, which would seem to me to be the character he's inhabited ever since, which is quite unusual actually for a rock star of his generation, because by and large rock stars try to stay forever young, don't they? I mean, Mick Jagger's the famous example of that. You can't imagine Mick Jagger sounding his age, but Bob Dylan at 50-ish clearly, I think, decided he was going to be a grumpy old man, or not a grumpy old man for last, but he was going to be his age, and he was going to explore that as for the rest of his career, and that really worked.
Yeah, I've heard it said other places that this is the first album made by an older person admitting they're an older person. So the Grammys, usually is kind of a cellophane trinket, but it certainly did anoint this album and solidify the reception for both publicly, as you said, the Heart episode was just before, so that's a cued the press up very well to have a reason to talk about him, and then the Grammy. And so that now we're sort of off to the races. Did you have a sense? I think you mentioned in the book something about him noticing people knowing the words, more quickly to these songs or something, but sort of him embracing that reaction. What did the Grammys mean to enable this next 20 years to be so different? Is that just a time in, happened to be a time mark in it, or do you really think a bunch of circumstances lined up to, push Bob up and high into the spotlight in a way that he obviously deserved, but also suited the career and created a new trajectory?
The Grammys is obviously just really marketing, isn't it? It's just the way the industry markets itself. And he was lucky to be given that slot, by the industry for that album. And that chimed with good reviews and the public were reacting positively, and the press were reacting in a good way, and because the work was fundamentally good. And so the Grammys and Columbia and all the kind of, you know, let's give it to Bob this year. And it'll help make us some more money. And that's what the Grammys is, like the Oscars. I mean, it's not an empirical test of quality. It's just a kind of marketing thing, an industry award ceremony, really. But of course, you know, he's no fool and he'll turn up and take it. He took them before, of course. It wasn't his first Grammy.
The difference between his, maybe 91 speech and 98 speech are pretty dramatic differences.
Well, I was thinking back to 79, I think he got it for Slow Train Coming. I think that was his first Grammy. I'm not even sure if that was the first, but he certainly turned up for the ceremony and he got a Grammy for that. And in 91, I think he was drunk, frankly. Drunk or he had the flu or both. Yeah. Oh, you mean the performance when he played? Do you mean the performance, the lovesick performance?
Well, I think both, meaning he gave a speech, you know, that thing about, you know, his father and so forth. And he played Masters of War. And if you can contrast those two to the lovesick performance, and his speech in 98, you know, this is a guy who probably looked older 8 years earlier, certainly less spry. Look, I think what I'm interested in and curious about is what's Bob's reaction. The match got lit and now he's on a new tear and it's sort of fun to see how's he reacting to that? Because in some ways story tries to tell us Bob's doing what Bob's doing and whatever's happening around him doesn't matter. But I do think that being celebrated and getting a positive reaction and selling things and so forth. I don't know. You talked to a lot more people. How did Bob feel about the reaction to this album? And all of a sudden it was very different than Under the Red Sky. And
I don't remember specifically. I don't know who told me that he was pleased. They were listening. I don't know who told me that. I know that I went to the shows then, and I remember the audience knew the songs. Maybe that's where it came from. So maybe it was just firsthand experience. He clearly believed in the songs because he played them all, you know, all the time. In concert, and they really worked really well in concert. So that was a good test of the material. Yeah.
And even up till last week, he's still playing it.
Yeah. Well, they're really good songs. I think it's about my favorite Dylan album, really. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything because one's favorites are very subjective, but it certainly seemed to be a wonderful return to form. And the great thing is he's kind of stayed pretty at a pretty high level ever since, really.
And so as we talked about briefly, so you've recently updated the book all the way up to Rough and Rowdy Ways. So maybe tell us a little bit about the update. What did you learn? Or is there, how do you see this 20 years since?
Well,
it's great to have a book like this that's so up to date. You know, it's so thorough in the old days. And yet I was really surprised flipping through and getting all the way, I'm sort of waiting for it to end. And all of a sudden it's, most foul. And
yeah. So the book was published in 2001, Down the Highway, when he was 60. We updated it in 2010 when he was 70, which was around about the time of Christmas in the Heart and Theme Time Radio Hour and all that stuff. And then we updated it again last year when he was 80. So it's now up to date with Rough and Rowdy Ways and selling his publishing. And but I mean, those 20 years, I mean, they've been 20 good years, haven't they? I mean, there's been some really strong albums like Love and Theft, and he's done a lot of different things. I mean, I thought the Theme Time Radio Hour thing was one of the best things he's done in many ways. It was just
fantastic.
It was fantastic. It was so human and, you know, funny and original, and it just was really good. His book was really good. I mean, I like the Christmas album. I think Rough and Rowdy Ways is really good. And there's been a couple of slightly less satisfying records, but he's been generally more consistent. And my sort of overarching observation would be that he has inhabited his age. He's been his age. He's acted his age throughout. And he now seems as old as God, really. But he's always seemed kind of old because he has this kind of air of wisdom about him, which kind of makes people look older, feel older than they are. But of course, now he really is old. I mean, my God, he's 80. He's going to be 81 this year. He's an old man. No two ways about it. So I think he's really done that well. He's he's really inhabited his age, and he's found a way to be an older rock star successfully, which most of them don't. And that's a great credit to him. And he's also obviously enjoyed himself by doing all these other projects, you know, the art and the books and the radio show.
Sculpture.
Yeah, the metal sculptures, which are rather wonderful, really, if you have half a million quid for a Bob Dylan garden gate. But they are rather wonderful. And, you know, you get the idea that he's constantly creative and restless and wanting to do stuff. And I'm sure all of this stuff he does, the paintings, the book, the books, the new book that's coming out, it's all part of his idea of being a creative person. Not as important as the music, of course, but it's all part of, it's all the same in his mind. He's expressing himself in all these different ways.
To end, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you about some of these people you interviewed and just see if anything, you know, comes to mind, because some of the names, as I say, are very interesting to obviously to Dylan fans who hear these names and almost never even hears a quote from them. Well, let's start with Suze Rotolo.
Well, she didn't like me at all, even though I sent her, even though I gave her flowers. And she didn't speak to me. I met her. I mean, I spoke to her, but she didn't cooperate. I can't remember. I pissed her off something about it pissed her off, or she wasn't happy with me. So we had a conversation outside her apartment in Manhattan. I remember it vividly because I tried so hard to get it right. I took her a huge bunch of lilies, which cost me a fortune. And, you know, I did everything I could to be charming, but I utterly failed to charm her.
I think I just saw a little YouTube of her sitting on a step, looks outside at a university, actually talking about Bob. But, you know, her and the former Mrs. Dylan are two you just don't hear much from. So it's not surprising. I think you had a brief call with Sarah, if I don't not
mistake. Yeah. Well, you're now enumerating all of my failures. So Sarah, who I was also, and to this day, Sarah Dylan is the great interview no one's ever got. But I did get her on the phone, and she very wearily said something like, I forget, it's in the book actually. She said something like, what did she say? I can't remember. Something like, oh, really?
Something like, you're not serious, or yeah.
Not quite that, but it was a bit more urbane than that. It was something like, oh, really? Or something like very world weary, you know, are you really going to ask me this? And then she kind of...
He wasn't even impressed that you got her on the phone, because even that is probably...
Yeah, and that wasn't, believe me, that wasn't easy.
Sally Grossman, you probably spoke to her, because I read that section of your book where the resolution, there was the lawsuit and the resolution was going on. Was that about the time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, broadly speaking, women are better interviews than men. And in this kind of a book, the women are often really the good interviews. But you're picking the ones which weren't actually the good interviews, but they are interesting people. I mean, Sally was a very tricky, defensive, prickly customer, very suspicious. And I had to go up to Woodstock twice. And finally, in kind of a car park at midnight, smoking cigarettes, we had a conversation. I mean, the Rick Danko conversation was even more difficult than that. That was on a tour bus, him taking drugs at night in the dark, rolling down the highway, you know, with me on the other side of the table. I mean, that was bizarre. I think he thought I was his roadie. Or I think I was there to help him. You know, I kind of volunteered to come along to help him, but rather than just, you know, there for the interview. But finally, he did give me the interview with the light switched off so he could kind of rummage in his drug bag and shoot up without me seeing. Wow. I can say this because I can say this because he's dead, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would love to hear more about, you know, I know you talked to Robbie. I think there's tons of band stuff. All right, two women that maybe you had more success with, Echo and Bonnie Beecher, two early relationships of Bob's. I think, again, you're one of the rare people to speak with.
Well, they're both just sweethearts. I mean, Echo was a sweetheart. I spoke to her just before she died, actually, up until recently. And, you know, she's got a very discreet tale to tell. I mean, she only knew Bob in this very discreet period of time, but nonetheless, she's an important character. And Bonnie's a total sweetie, you know. I mean, she's the wife of Wavy Gravy, who's another lovely guy, and she's alive, you know, in the Bay Area. Another really good interview was, who people probably don't know, was, Carol somebody, one of the girlfriends, the record company.
Childs.
Yeah, she was really good. She was really good because she's what you want from an interview is somebody who is indiscreet, expresses themselves well, and doesn't give a shit what people think. And she was all those things. And so there's some really good quotes from her. Actually, I kind of bury them a bit in the prologue or in the introduction, but she was very good on Bob, very insightful. Women are good on men because they see through all their bullshit and they know them in a way that men don't know them. You know, the guy who plays the bass guitar behind Bob for 5 years doesn't go to bed with him. You know, it's a different relationship, obviously. But the woman the woman in his bed knows him, really knows him. And that's why you should always interview the women, not the men necessarily.
Okay. And one surprising name on the list, I thought this was great, was William Zantzinger. You had that conversation.
That was good. So that was a good bit of journalism, really. That's kind of a good example of what I did for this book. Whereas Dylan kind of authors seems to me often, many of them just kind of write about their kind of O-level English idea of what the lyrics mean. But I actually go and see people and ring them up. And I looked in the phone book and William Zantzinger was in the phone book in 1999. He was still alive. He was in the phone book in Baltimore. And I rang him up one day and I said, you know, what a wonderful name. You know, there's only one William Zantzinger in the phone book. And as you would expect, he was an aggressive, nasty bastard. And he said some nasty things, which were very quotable. And in fact, I taped him and I made that into a Radio 4, BBC Radio 4 in England, radio documentary, which in fact, I'm sure you can still hear somewhere, called The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. So that was a good one. That was a good interview. Some interviews, by the way, are very, very short, but nonetheless very, very important. You know, you can speak to someone for 5 minutes. I think Zantzinger was 5 minutes, but that's really important. Some people, you speak to them for hours and hours. I spoke to Garth Hudson for days, and he hardly said a thing that was intelligible. You know, it was just so frustrating. You know, some people are just so difficult to actually get through to. Some people give you 5 minutes. Robbie Robertson, for instance, gave me a few minutes and every single thing he said was quotable. And that's a really interesting thing writing biographies, is you see how very, very different people are. And you never know until you get hold of them. You never know what they're going to be like.
Well, on behalf of the Dylan fan community, that all that work you did, we appreciate. The book Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan, updated all the way to 2022, but it goes through every phase in, you know, amazing detail, and it's this aggregation of all this research and these points of view. I mean, there's many Dylan books and I've read many of them, but this is really a worthwhile, valuable one. So I appreciate that work, and thanks, Howard, for being willing to chat today.
Okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Craig.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Howard and strongly recommend his book to all Dylan fans, Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan. Thank you for joining us for this episode. Coming up, we have some incredible things on future episodes, so please subscribe, leave a comment, and join us, become a member at freakmusic.club. We'll see you again soon for more on Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind.
Don't forget to subscribe and rate this podcast. It really helps. For bonus episodes and more, become a member at freakmusic.club/join. And you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at FMC_Dylan. Thanks for listening.